God is the central figure and hero of this story. As much as we might want to think about Broadway plays and, you know, coats of many colors and that sort of thing, God is actually the central figure of this story. It's not a story about human hard work and success. It's a story about divine sovereignty. Joseph in this story is simply elected. And the dreams, those are God's unsettling work. They are unstoppable, and they are this invisible force. And you could even say that in this story, without the dreams, there's no story to tell. That everything depends on these dreams. And it's these dreams that will end up rescuing the people of God. But you could be forgiven to ask, really? What dream could possibly make sense of these scenes in one's life? Betrayal by one's siblings? Desertion by their family? Exposed to powerful sexual temptation? Punished for doing the right thing? Enduring long imprisonment? Only to be forgotten by those you served with your whole heart. Kind of hard to think of a dream that would make sense of all that. But it reminds us, and I found myself as I sat with this text this week, I found a growing respect for God. I felt like I was tapping into something that I like knew in my deepest guts when I was, you know, first converted 40 years ago. I felt this, you know, sometimes we use the word awe, or the, you know, God is awesome. And I found that kind of thing growing in me as I realized, as I've said before, that it's just as straightforward as anything, that election is a major thread in Genesis. And when Paul in Romans 9 through 11 is trying to make sense of what God's doing in this, you know, way later part of the story, he says that thinking of this thread of election, that before the twins of Isaac and Rebekah had done anything good or bad, in order that God's purpose in election might stand. I mean, it's hard to think of five or six more important words in all of the Bible. In order that God's purposes in election might stand, Rebekah was told, the older will serve the younger. And so this is what then begins to alert us that things like the coat really aren't the issue. The issue is what the coat signifies. The coat signified a preferential love of Jacob the father for this son. And Israel's being told in the telling of this story in the same way that God has a preferential kind of love for you. So the coat really even is a picture of election. Now again, I there's got to be somebody in the room thinking, well, this sermon is starting out sort of doctrinaire. You know, what is the deal with thinking about a doctrine like election? Well, here's the deal. The deal is election helps us answer the question, who am I? In fact, I think we could go so far to say, I don't know of any other way to answer that question. I mean, we try to create all kinds of ways to create a self. Are you feeling me here? We try all kinds of ways to create a self. When this story of the origins of humanity wants to tell us that if you want to be in the flow of this generative life that's coming from God, well, that has to do with something that God's doing. And so it helps us answer further questions like, why am I here? What's the purpose and meaning of my life? If I am elected, how then should I live? So the doctrine of election teaches us that Christian spirituality is not a private affair about eternal life or my own personal security and happiness. It's not about special privilege. Rather, election is a particular and public responsibility. That is to say that we, the elect, are to be the bearers of God's divine power and blessing, just like Joseph was. To be the elect means to be incorporated into the mission of God. It means this simply: the one is chosen for the many. The particular are chosen for the general. And this is actually a very important thing for 21st century evangelism. How would you, if you lived in India, speak to a Hindu who said to you, "Why should we listen to this dopey little tribe and some of their leaders when we've had as beautiful, as powerful, as poignant spiritual writings as you guys have had, and we had it before you?" And the Hindu notion of God is that God is able to speak individually and does speak directly individually to people, and there's no need for any sort of special representation. How would you speak to them? Now, you might say, "Well, I'm not an Indian. I don't plan on being a missionary there." But it makes its way into our culture in things that we used to call like the New Age movement. We don't talk that way anymore. But today there is this sense that Christianity is kind of a bullying thing. It seeks to enforce the story of this one ethnic little tribe called the Jews and their crazy patriarchs. They were flipping crazy. And you're going to enforce that story onto the whole world as if Christianity has some sort of privileged position vis-a-vis the other world religions? This is big stuff. And there's one answer to it. And the answer is the clue to history, the clue to all human history, is what the elect one did on the cross. And how he is the image of what it means to be human in the image of God. The one is elect to serve the general. The Jews, beginning with Abraham, are elect to be God's rescue force on the earth. His sort of cosmic first responders. That's the answer. There is no other answer. Everything else will sound just like religious bullying. Furthermore, if we think of our personal lives and not just kind of global religious affairs, I want to say that a deep sense of election, a deep sense of God and I are doing something together here in my little life, and this is what makes me a self. This is the only real source that I know of for human confidence. In my lifetime, I've seen kind of two options for human confidence. I grew up in a extraordinary liberal United Methodist Church just a couple miles away in Santa Ana. And what was reigning today then was, is we shouldn't put our confidence in anything really because we can't really know anything and religion is really slippery and there's nothing really to stand on. And then I was converted into a kind of populist fundamentalism that really was not very good at like holding together the real complexities of human life. And so then lots of people today, you know, it's not for no reason that the fastest growing aspect of American culture are people who want nothing to do with church because they stand there and they look at these two things, which are the babies, you might say, of scientism of the last 400 or 500 years, and they say, "Well, I can't be a liberal, I think there's something going on, but I don't want to be an angry fundamentalist. Where can I stand? How's a human being to have any confidence about anything?" And the answer is this respect that there is a God who is superintending history. And that for whatever reason, he has made his choices, what we now call election. He has made his divine purposes, his divine intentions, what we now call election, to be the tool or the way through which human beings would find both a kind of groundedness for themselves and a way of being in the world that the world would experience ourself as for their good. This is the groundedness that we read about in our gospel reading. Jesus knows what's about to happen to him. So he says, "Judas, you would betray the Son of Man with a kiss?" And of course, you know, all of the people around him who don't know his groundedness, and I don't mean they don't know it intellectually, they don't know experientially Jesus' groundedness, his deep groundedness. And so they say, "Lord, shall we strike with a sword?" And paraphrasing here, Jesus says, "Leave it alone. This is their hour. Just leave it be, it's okay. This is the hour of darkness. But darkness is not superintending human history. Again, are you feeling me here? Darkness is not what superintends human history. Darkness gets included in human history. For whatever reason, Jesus allows rival kingdoms to even impact him. In this case, he calls it the kingdom or the power of darkness. But he says, even in this, and this is okay, this is their hour, this is their power of darkness. Now, this raises a crucial issue because the contrast to groundedness goes something like this. Really? You'd murder your brother over a coat and a couple of boastful dreams? Really? You'd murder your brother because dad prefers him and he had a couple of arrogant dreams. Well, what happens is a deep sort of jealousy comes on these brothers, a fear, it grows into an ugly rage, it blinds them to what is right, even on the most basic level, that this is my journey. And we can't get into this, but what happened to Joseph was torturous. A 30-day journey through the desert, probably chained hand and foot, treated like baggage, sold as a commodity. Who would do that to a family member? Well, somebody who doesn't have this kind of grounded in a self, in a self that's grounded in God and I are doing something together in my little life. And this is why the scriptures say things like refrain from anger and turn from wrath. It only leads to evil. Jesus said, Matthew 5, Moses said, don't murder. I say to you, don't hate, because hate puts you in big danger. Paul wrote to the Ephesians, let all bitterness, wrath, anger, and malice be put away from you. The writer of Hebrews said, see to it that no root of bitterness springs up, causing trouble and defiling many. And Jesus, finally explaining all this, says, for out of the heart proceed evil thoughts and murders. Now, I need you to hear this. In 5 years, that's probably the longest string of scriptures I've ever read to you. And I want you to hear that those are not proof texts to form a system of religious law. Those scriptures and scores of others just like them are meant to form a spiritual vision of the good and light life for those who are already safe under the reign of God. They already have a deep sense of election. They have a deep sense of my little self matters. I don't have to make myself into some other kind of self. Myself as I presently experience it matters and is good. And so then I don't have to use anger's outward actions to control my life or anybody else in order to make myself safe. And then this is sort of Joseph's role in the play, you might say. As Joseph stands as this towering figure of moment by moment patient obedience. And he shows this sometimes that living the dream is not living the dream. Sometimes living the dream is difficult and has profound darkness associated with it. But then it kind of calls to us to say, well, okay, how can I live in some sort of moment by moment patient obedience? And this story, and this is where it stands not only in the Bible, in the story of Israel and in the unfolding story of the scripture, but I think stands in us as a listening community pastorally this morning, is that it's an invitation to trust the ordinary events of our lives to God, who though largely hidden, did you notice God is like nowhere in this story? No reference to him? No one thinks about him or calls on him? And this is true in our life. God is largely hidden. I mean, we see and experience the tiniest little, you know, millisecond experiences of him, but God is largely hidden in his wisdom. But though he is largely hidden, he's still bringing creation and us to our intended completion. Now, we won't read this in our studies in Genesis, but in Genesis 41, when Joseph is interpreting dreams for Pharaoh, Pharaoh has the same dream twice. And when Joseph interprets it for him, he says, well, the reason you had the same dream twice is that means the matter has been firmly determined by God. Well, who else had the same dream twice? He did. The same basic dream twice. And as he, you know, gets into his career, you might say, in Egypt, and he begins to get little flickering kind of little, you know, jolts of insight that God is actually working with him, he realizes what's happening. On the other hand, Joseph's brothers could not see that even their evil actions were the vehicle through which God's will was being done, and how God's presence and provision was in each of these seemingly tragic moments and circumstances in ways that Joseph could for not see or imagine at that time either. So here's why election is not merely a doctrine for Bible school. Again, it's meant to bring to our conscious awareness myself in relation to the one true Creator God who is bringing creation to its intended completion. One of my mentors used to frequently say something like this to me, and I heard him say it to many others, something like this. God has yet to bless anyone except where they actually are. And if we faithlessly discard situation after situation, moment after moment, as not being right, Lord, this isn't right that my brothers hate me. Well, this moment doesn't matter. Lord, it's not right that now my father even won't stick with me. Well, I guess this moment doesn't matter. Lord, it's not right that what my brothers are doing to me threw me in this cistern. I guess this moment doesn't matter. Lord, it's not right. I thought it was going to be right. It looked like Reuben was going to save me, but now it's not right that I'm being into Egypt. And what we do is we end up, as I've said before, wishing our actual life away. But our life is only precisely the moments that kind of come one after another as they present ourselves to us. And if we faithlessly say that those don't count or that God will bless me when things are right, then we will never actually find ourselves engaging with our actual self, the one that is in fear maybe, or pain, or worried, or anxious. Or maybe you've been recently betrayed. So what we end up doing is saying, well, this life, these things don't matter, but when things are right, well, then God will be able to bless me. And the doctrine of election tells us that we don't have to live in that nuttiness, that every moment of our life can count. Having this deep knowledge, again, not a theological knowledge, not could you answer this right on a test in Bible school, but something that says, I realize that God is able to interact with human rebellion and various circumstances in life, like a camel caravan that saves Joseph's life. He's able to interact with these human things such that his will is done without turning me or you into a robot. God is so great, he's so wise, he's so powerful that he's able to do this. And so then a key spiritual challenge, it's kind of the last thing I want to say to you here this morning, a really key spiritual challenge for us in our own growth as followers of Jesus is that I think this story invites us to just kind of check our reactions to life. Do we tend to be fatalistic? And fatalism, it sort of faithfully embraces the circumstances of life, but it has no Godwardness to it. You know, at best is maybe deistic, that maybe God's out there somewhere, but I just sort of have to accept my fate. Or there's kind of a primitivism that often goes along with kind of fundamentalism that is, you know, just wants to make everything ultra oversimple, but it's thoughtless about actual human complexity and the things that actually happen to human beings. Or we could select a kind of humanism that refuses to believe much of anything about God. Fatalism, primitivism, humanism. Or what about this? What about a different way that's rooted in there is a God who has chosen a people that for those chosen people, it would be for their good, even when it looks bad. And for the rest of the people, this select people, the particular, would be good for all. And so this is not a hollow kind of I'll show you dopey humans kind of sovereignty. This, think of the story that you heard read for you again. See if you can place the story before your mind right now. This is a election, a sovereignty meant to feed and sustain God's cooperative friends. Without Joseph, there is no continuation of Israel. So this isn't a, check this out, God, I'll show you. This isn't God defending his honor This isn't God showing how sovereign he is. This is an election in a deep, tender purpose to feed the earth. So when the prophets of Israel reflect on these kind of things, as Isaiah did, they say things like, as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are your ways higher than our ways, and your thoughts higher than my thoughts. Or again, Paul reflecting on this in that same passage, only this time in Romans 11. Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments, how mysterious his ways, for who's ever known the mind of the Lord? That's true. Everything I just read to you is true. But here's what's also true, and actually this makes this true, that while God's ways might be unsearchable, they are sure and reliable and trustworthy. This is not a blind leap. This is the only sensible foundation for any kind of meaningful faith. We can't simultaneously say that God is hidden and mysterious and his ways are above ours, and then, you know, just again, that sits in our head as a theological construct. No, that theological construct is meant to say this is something you can come to rely on. You can place your confidence in it. You can trust it. You can live your actual life in all of its up and down moments as if this is true. So in our last quiet moment here, I want to ask you a question that I sat with this week that comes from Walter Brueggemann's thoughts on this passage. This is a question I want to invite you to sit with. What dream is still being dreamed over you? What dream is still being dreamed over your family, your church, your nation? Or if this is better for you, you might sit and wonder for a moment, what promise is being guarded by God on your behalf? Amen.